that's when we have really changed our company from a, you know, linear and more about making money than truly as a purpose-driven organization, that we want to make a huge change in this environment. And by doing that, our staff understands they're coming into to a company that has a purpose, and we also truly can make a huge impact for ESGs and companies internally for us and for our environmental partners.
Welcome to the Manufacture Houston podcast, where Houston's manufacturers come to share, learn, and grow. Brought to you by Alchemy Industrial. For more information, check out alchemyindustrial.com.
On today's episode of the Manufacture Houston podcast, we talked to Rick Perez, who founded Avangard Innovative at his parents' dinner table about 30 years ago. Now, Avangard Innovative is one of the world's largest companies that is transforming plastic waste into commercial products. I know you'll love today's episode. Rick Perez, thanks for joining us on the podcast today. How are you doing, man?
I'm doing great, Mush, and thank you for having me.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, look, I love your story, and I've known about your story for about 10 years now, and I would love it if we just start with intro about you, who you are, your background, and then we'll talk about the business too, and where it began and where it is now, because I think it's a great American success story, and I think people would love to hear it. So tell us about you, Rick.
Thank you so much. Well, my story is the American dream, right? I mean, I was 8 years old. I was born in Mexico City. I came to this country when I was eight. I didn't speak a lick of English. I was very fortunate to have my parents saw the vision, the strategy to think that, speaking English would be very helpful. So that's how the journey started. We moved to Katy, Texas, and that whole ride there was great. And then it started being going to school at U of H. And then at the same time, parallel to that, I realized, I was working as a waiter at Outback Steakhouse and Olive Garden. I did all these jobs, mowing lawns, all the things that I thought it was great. And just as opportunity showed up to go look at PET bottles back in the day when there were returnable bottles and they would all come back to a Coke and Pepsi. And I flew down to Mexico and I saw football fields full of this stuff. And I came back and started my business at my parents' house with $1,000 that I had saved up from waiting tables. And that's how the journey started on Avangard Innovative and where we are today.
Now, the rumor has it that you were also a quarterback with the 80 football team. Is that true or did I hear that wrong?
Yeah, that was true. But, that and a cup of coffee, these are great players. But it was, yes, I think sports in general, I think it's the foundation of being a good leader and the ability to work with others. And truly, I think team experiences and, losing some games when you think you should have won and that desire to win. I always say play to win. And I think sports is such a valuable part of a great teamwork in business as well.
I agree with that. And I've heard you say this expression, play to win. What does that mean to you, Rick? When you say it, what is that? Why is that so meaningful to you?
Well, to me, I think it's what's happening. And I always see companies or people that always say, well, they, when you talk to your staff or you talk to anybody, they say, no, these guys, they won't accept that. They won't agree to that. And my question is always to them, do you believe in it? And if you think you're saying the right thing, why would they say no? So what I mean by play to win is think of a strategy that you will win whenever you're presenting to a customer, what we call environmental partners, or just even your colleagues, be able to prepare something that you're there to win. Not if you're already going into a negotiation, assuming that you're not going to win, then why go in the first place? So that's my thought process is not putting boundaries and going in prepared to win a game, prepared to be winning a negotiation, a contract, whatever it is, just play to win.
And I've seen you do that firsthand as you've taken on the challenges that you've had in your business. So let's go back to your story. So PET bottles was where you began. And I think you've told me before that you started out with like a big Thomas register sitting in front of you. And I don't even know people still remember what Thomas registers are. You and I are old enough to know what it is, but tell us from that time you had that big green book in front of you and those early days and years and what it took for you to get to, you know, just get the business going.
Yeah, that's pretty funny. Not much, but yeah, the Thomas registers were back in before Google, which people don't understand because now you just punch anything in and you can see it in the internet or find a company. But back in the day, how would you find a company in the middle of, you know, anywhere in this country? And the only way to do it, you had to have these Thomas Register books that were huge green books that you could find it. So you would dial it for dollars back in the day. And that's really the culture my dad was able to make me work. I mean, he made me work since I was very young and I learned to do that. And so long story short, I started in the Thomas Register books and I looked at polyester and I looked at their opportunity with carpet manufacturers to use recycled material, which is PET bottles, which is they're made out of polyester. And so we started exporting them from Mexico into the United States, the Coke bottles. And we were just lucky enough and I guess a little bit of vision, a lot of luck to become the largest recycler in the world for PET bottles. We were the fifth largest country as a private company of PET bottles. And then we built a facility to make FDA certified plastic resin that goes back in the bottles. So truly closed loop recycling and circular economy. And then we were fortunate enough to sell it to Mexico, to Coca-Cola in Mexico. And they're still the largest plant in the world today.
Well, so why sustainability? Was it something way back when you started your company where that was an idea for you, where you thought that, hey, there's something here that I need to get involved with? Or was it just a beginning point for you in business and maybe you didn't think about where you began? Tell us more about your motivation there.
Yeah, you know, Mush, to be honest, I mean, you know, I looked at the opportunity back then. You know, as you get, you know, now you're talking 30 years later. But yeah, I mean, I would love to tell you that was my purpose. This was a green initiative and saving the environment, do the right thing for your social responsibility and so on. But that's not really where it started. I mean, it started green for money first. I thought an opportunity for that. But the evolution, right? And as you get, you realize what a big impact we're doing for a lowering carbon footprint and helping companies with their ESG score and truly creating circular economy. That's when we have really changed our company from a, you know, linear and more about making money than truly as a purpose-driven organization that we want to make a huge change in this environment. And by doing that, our staff knowing their stands are coming into a company that has a purpose. And we also truly can make a huge impact for ESGs and companies internally for us and for our environmental partners.
Well, that's great, Rick. And so you began the business with PET, sold that business or a portion of it to Coca-Cola, but you kept going down this road. And tell us about sort of the next stage of the types of things that your company began collecting and repurposing and commercializing.
Yeah, you know, I think it's any great organization understands how to pivot, and any organization needs to understand how, I call it rebirth. You have to rethink yourself how to start your business again. And sometimes you just start all over. And basically, as the one-way bottles and went to, you know, to landfill, to single stream, we figured that out. Then we sold the PT. But at the same time, we looked at the very inefficient waste business, right? The waste side of how most major organizations, whether you're in grocery or automotive or furniture, you name it, that industry, nobody looks at the back of a store. Everybody focuses on the very front. And I always looked at the back and realized, wait a minute, all of that material that is packaged, how can we make that more efficient? Why are things going to a landfill when we can capture it and monetize it for a company? And so, you know, the evolution already started. We were a trading business, right? We started it and then we would trade material all over the world. Now we decided that's not really what we do. So we went and added, we created it to sustain our technology. So we use machine learning. We use artificial intelligence to identify recyclables. inside your compactor balers and ways. I mean, in balers. And what we do is now we have true data driving, especially major players that have hundreds or thousands of locations, real-time data, and we're changing culture. So that is, you know, now we start with that, which is creates transparency, auditing, right? Now you can audit the transactions. You can audit your waste stream. So whenever you are reporting for your ESG, you have it all in one dashboard. And the other thing is we move from the data play, but also to really manufacturing. And what we ended up doing is taking what most people call single-use plastics, but primarily low density and linear low, which would be your flexible packaging, which is the hardest thing to recycle. And now we created a manufacturer here in North Houston, which is the largest one in America, is to process that. That's 75% less carbon footprint than prime resin. So now what we're doing is we're creating into products that will go into the supply chain, will go into the shelves, will go back to the consumer. And then that product now with 75% less carbon footprint, we make it an effort how to get that back. And we have all these recollections and sites to drop off and all these centers. Now we can get that back and redo the same thing, repurpose the material again, right back to the consumer. So true circular economy.
Well, that's an incredible business that you've built to figure out how to go from that very inefficient back of the store to now creating products and providing data to your environmental partners to know exactly how, where they are in this sort of recycling and sustainability process. I want to go a bit deeper on something that you said earlier that's, I think, fascinating, a great lesson for young entrepreneurs about leaning into where businesses are inefficient. And the whole idea of back of the store where, and it's not sexy, it's not fun, but there's tremendous opportunity back there because talented people aren't really looking there. Tell us more about how you navigated your way through and your team navigated its way through handling all that back of the store stuff.
No, that's great. Yeah. First and foremost, Mush, as you know, to create a great organization, you have to have great people. So I've been fortunate enough to have the best team around me. Most of our staff has been with us for a long, long time, and we continue to grow and evolve and bring in better talent, new talent, and evolve that. So first and foremost, people. The second is when you look in the back of a location or store, you're right. It's just finding where, as a company, you can add value. And what we realized, the bigger and the messier they were, the harder for them to understand what they have in 2,200 locations, you know, 3,000 or 400. And it's not that the fact that they can't do it. The business, their businesses is not to follow the trash, right? Their business and recyclables, their business is the front of the store and how to sell products to the consumer. So then I realized that the focus is of a customer, or we call environmental partner, they don't have the staff or the ability to do that. And it's just like accounting, right? You use an outside firm to certify and audit your books. You utilize outside counsel. So we are basically their exterior environmental partners. And we have, you know, 800 plus employees in 11 countries doing that. So we're a little bit of glorified dumpster divers, but that's what we do.
That's right. Yeah, I just have this picture of like Rick Perez's legs up in the air as you're fishing around inside a dump. I would imagine that you've probably done something like that before.
There's a bunch of pictures like that, yes. And yeah, you know, that's the only way to learn. You got to get in the trenches, correct? I mean, you really have to look inside the dumpster, what was in there. And that's how we created the technology Sustain, because I realized, man, they don't smell that great. So why can we use something else instead of bodies to be looking at that? And that's how we came up with our technology. So yes, that's exactly what we used to do.
That's great. So you've talked about Sustain and this idea of data, and you began thinking about this at least 6 or 7 years ago. Everybody's talking about data now. Everybody.
Correct.
Everybody's talking about ESG now. But this has been a pretty long journey for you. What was that original insight for you where you thought about, you know, I've got to measure this waste stream a little differently? And when exactly did you begin really thinking about that and implementing the concept of data in your business?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. And really, you know, again, it's being having access to opportunities. I think one of the what happened in my case, I was doing a public engagement, and it was the head strategist from Google, and the head analytics for MasterCard, and me, and we were going to go on stage, and there's probably, I don't remember exactly, but 800 to 1,000 people, and we were having lunch right before that. And I was at, they were, you know, Google was talking about autonomous cars. As you can imagine, how long ago was that? And I was asking them, why would Google be in part of that? So, Rick, we're the fastest data processing company in the world. Why this is purely a data play? And he said something to me right as about to go to on stage. He goes, if you're not in the data business, you are nobody. And I was like, oh, and I was about to get on stage to talk about dumb equipment with really no data. It's and waste and processing. So that I realized then it's like, we have to find a way. And I'm very fortunate to have a partner that I call him my little Wozniak, that, you know, he was a lead engineer, created the first 3D printer. I call him after that. I said, we got to get in the data business. And we kind of, I pitched him the idea, and there's been an evolution ever since. And so that's what we, you know, we decided that the waste and recycling, you treat it like any other industry. You got to automate it. You have to create technology. You have to, and that it helps internally and externally. And that's how we can drive. You know, we have over 20,000 locations that feed into our network. And it, the only way to manage that is really through technology to drive that customer excellence and really make that economic benefit and the social responsibility benefit, all of that.
Rick, tell us more about the challenge of transforming your organization to think about data, because you had an organization that was sort of a leading edge, but still sort of a traditional waste management business. And then now you're thinking, you came back from this meeting with the Google guy, and he's got you all excited about data and tells you you're nothing unless you're in data. So was it difficult for you to transform your organization to think that way? And what was that journey like for you and your team?
Well, the hardest thing you'll ever see is when you come in to an organization and you say, guys, we were trading recycling and focus on waste optimization to now we're a data company. And this is how we're going to drive it. You could imagine my leadership team. They're like, okay, this guy's lost his marbles, which it happens several times in my career. But at the end of the day, you have to continue. You know, it's a repetition, and you have to get buy-in on the organization. And it takes a while to do that. And you know, at the end of the day, you have the right people to be able to adopt that idea. But again, you know, it's a process, and it takes time, right? Sadly, it's not something that clicks on it. You know, sometimes visionaries are misunderstood, and it takes a while for people to see you where you're going to try to go or why you're trying to do it. Because as soon as, you know, say, but that's not what we do today. And I said, correct. That's not what we do today. That doesn't mean that's not what we're going to do tomorrow. And so, but that's my job, right? I look outwards, not inwards. So that blend and that transitions take time. But now I can promise you my staff, the same ones that fought me on it, now they're like, we cannot do it without it. So I think everybody has adopted it. Everybody looks at it. The organization looks at it. And it's just now getting your customers to, I always, you know, we have a little kind of a saying that how do you service old technology? And we don't anymore. So if you had a, you know, a Motorola flip phone, well, we can't service that anymore. So, but we have a, you know, if you have an iPhone 11, we can definitely do that. Or, you know, or we have a little saying, if we're trying to get you from Houston to New York, we'll give you Google Maps or we'll give you a key map. Which would you take? And so that's kind of, you're trying to simplify the story for the environmental partner, understanding that all the benefits that come with that. But it takes time.
And that makes sense that it would take time, not only with your internal organization, but with the outside world too, because one of the, I think, implications of being a leader when it comes to talking about data is that you're also trying to get external adoption. And I would imagine that there's a few people that went first. Is that fair to say in terms of the outside world?
Oh, absolutely. And you know, it that's the hardest thing, because you may have a great idea, right? But who's first to market, and who's going to be able to adopt it from a large scale public Fortune 500 companies? A lot of times, our process and the ability to innovate is not that great. So they're comfortable with the old way of doing things, or even the whole process of turning, right? From procurement all the way to operations. They don't understand the world of technology advancement. Oh, and really where we have the big adoption was a technology play company, pretty much the largest, some of the largest in the world, but they come from a world that they use data, they use robotics, they use automation. And so when they realized what we were doing, for them, that's all the way they run their businesses. So we started there. And then you start having adoption for the bricks and mortar businesses that realize the results were positive, case studies. And, you know, again, then nobody can argue with data, correct? So if you can prove it now, the model's correct, and you've delivered it, there's nothing to argue about. It's just pure data. It'll tell you that did it work or didn't.
That's right. Yeah, it makes sense. And so I want to press on this ESG angle a little bit with you, because once again, I think you were ESG before ESG was cool. And I can't remember the phrase that you had, but you came up with this index or a metric or some kind of a measure that described how well your environmental partners were actually handling sustainability. What was the name of that metric?
Yeah, it's a beautiful thing. Me and you know each other for a long time. But yes, the answer was we created an index that before ESG happened, and we called it capture percentage rate. And really, if you think about it, what we were looking for, we believe companies do not generate more garbage or more recyclables. So the zero sum game, right? So how do we take their supply chain, figure out what they're actually bringing in and what is getting generated? And our logic behind that is let's measure what was going to a landfill. Now it's going to a baler. Now we're monetizing. Now we're doing the right things for the environment, and we can prove that out. And so that's exactly what ESG now, obviously there's governance, you know, environmental and social, but whilst you're doing all of this, if you really start with the basics of capturing the data and you're capturing the waste stream and you pull out all the recyclables, exactly what it's doing is generating your ESG. So we did come up with a capture percentage rate index before ESG started, correct.
When was that? That had to be almost 10 years ago.
It's been a long time. Yeah, I mean, that's the way we used to run our business to show the benefits. But now it's called ESG, and which is a great thing.
It is a great thing. And you, I think you're making such an interesting point around ESG. And I think companies are struggling with this now. There's the qualitative side, the story of ESG, which is great. But then there's the prove it, that you're actually doing it. And I think your business and your approach and your team's approach has many years of data that companies can use now to sort of measure how were things before and what can they do now and into the future.
Absolutely. And that, the travel knowledge goes a long way, right? We know by industry typically where a company could get to. Now with our technology, you can track it. We can see there is no argument of what the opportunities are. And then if you look at it, there's that transparency. So true companies can, when they say they're going to be, you know, carbon neutral or zero waste to landfill, we can do all of that because we're even certified, true certified. We can take a company all the way to zero waste to landfill. So the answer is they're doing it. And I think the adoption of ESG, and if you look at the capital markets where they're going, companies with higher ESG are having way higher valuations. So now it's everyone, all the stakeholders, all the employees, so everybody within the organization, all the way from the CEO down to, you know, the whole storefronts or whatever, they're part of this as a holistically into solving and increasing and better our planet. And why wouldn't you not, right? I mean, there's no reason. The solutions are there, the technology is there, the opportunities are there. So why wouldn't you do the right thing for the environment and make money doing it? I mean, that's the bottom line.
Yeah. And I think I think a lot of people have this sort of false trade-off between amazing environmental performance and great and amazing financial performance. And I think you're showing your environmental partners and others how that doesn't have to be a trade-off. That in fact, maybe the only way to do it is to solve both together.
No, absolutely. We believe it's a multiplier. So if you're doing the right thing by the environment, and on top of that, the more we capture, the less your hauling costs or landfill costs are going to be. And then the more we monetize your recycling. So you're receiving money you're increasing your ESG score. Now you can prove that out to the capital markets. That means, and you're all the primary stakeholders that want you to do the right thing, because a consumer is expecting you to do the right thing now. So, and if you look at everybody within that supply chain wins. So, you know, what we realize is most companies that generate products now, they're looking at end of life and what can their product and packaging be so the end of life can go back into circular economy. And those are the discussions that really excite me, because when you're designing products, you're designing the resin, you're designing the packaging and what you're going to put on the shelf. Nobody ever worried about, well, what's going to happen at the end of that cycle. And that's the beauty. What's going to happen is everyone is looking at end of life, and we're part of those discussions in the supply chain that we were never brought before. And now it's a big part of it. So it's a great thing what's happening right
now. I agree. And so that sort of brings us to this, the I don't want to say the final chapter of your business, because I suspect there's 20 more chapters out there, but the latest chapter of your business, which I think you launched again 4 or 5 years ago, something like that, where you're really trying to figure out how to wrap your arms around the current final stages of the supply chain. And so you made another big bet in the business, and that you're really rethinking that part of it too. So give us more information about this next chapter of your business and what you're doing there.
Yeah, well, absolutely. So, you know, at the end of the day, when we always, whether good or bad, we've always felt that we got to lead the industry, and we feel that the flexible packaging side, you know, it's getting a bad rap on the plastic side. And by the way, we're neutral to whatever product or packaging comes in. We got to find solutions for it. But what we did see is on the flexible packaging side, there was a huge opportunity on how do we create a, you know, thousands of formulations that are out there. So water over wrap to 6-pack rings to cleaner bags and you name it, on mattresses. How do we take that and create a standard spec and very close to resemblance to what a traditional prime resin would look like? And so we call it environmental additive. So we're not in the resin business. We manufacture an environmental additive that's 75% less carbon footprint. And so as we developed our strategy and we developed the relationships with real key players, customers, packaging companies. So we deal with the largest packaging companies in the world, the largest retailers in the world. And they're all so, they want that in their products. All the brand owners want that in their product. The major problem was, can you do it consistently and hit in a certain spec? And can you make it in the scale large enough to have an impact within their products? So we had to decide to go large. And so we built the largest facility in Americas to do that. And then we ended up going into figuring out exactly what we've learned in the last 30 years, how to handle plastics, and flexible is something that we took on and we figured it out. So again, teamwork. You know, we've done a very big strategic partnerships. Dow is our strategic partner from a resin producer that understands they're doing the right thing. They're working with us and also want to lower their carbon footprint and figure out what the end of life is for their resin. So we're working with us. But like that, we have several partnerships like Hycon, an ITW company. Now, every 6-pack ring in the world is made with our resin with our environmental additive in there, which is 55%. With 70, you know, that increase or lowers our carbon footprint by 55%. And not only that, we ended up doing, how do you get that back to us, right? So now recycle me, you go in there, you can typically just print it out and it go right to our plant. You put your, or you go to drop at the, you know, storefront, grocery stores and so on, and we get that back. So it's creating the recollection process from the consumer and make it easy for the consumer, all the way back to our facility, make the product right back and put it back into the shelves back to the consumer. That's the whole thing we're trying to create here, circular economy.
I love this, Rick. I mean, just as your friend too, I'm just listening to the story and I've heard this story several times, but listening to the story from beginning to end, it just makes me very happy to see the success story that you've created and your team has created. So I want to put you in a time machine. So I want to take you back to that young Rick Perez with the first time he opened the that Thomas Register. And if you were sitting there talking to that guy, what would you tell him? What would you tell him about the things to think about, lessons learned? What kind of guidance would you give him?
That's a great question, Lush. You know, if I look back, first of all, this is the beautiful thing about this country, right? If you work hard, you can achieve pretty much anything. You know, what I would tell that guy first is surround yourself with people, ask more questions and learn a little bit. Shorten the learning curve. In 30 years, I made a million mistakes and I wish I could kind of get some of those back. But again, I think the journey is important. I think it teaches a little bit of, what I always say right now, I think the last 30 years of learning and failing, getting us back up and pivoting the company is put us in the spot that we are today to continue to scale and make a big impact here for ESG and our company future and our stakeholders. So, you know, what I would say is, you know, do the same thing. I don't know if I would do anything different except to really reach out. I mean, knowing what I know now, of course it'd be completely different, but yet again, I don't know if the same journey would be the same. I've had fun with it. And part of our core values is, as you know, is have fun. And I truly enjoy what I do. I think our staff does, everybody around us is, you have to enjoy what you're doing. And, you know, there's job, there's career, and there's some lifestyle. And so all I know is this is my lifestyle. This is what I do. So I don't have a job. I don't have a career. I have a lifestyle and I just love it.
Well, that's great. That's great. And I think that would be great advice for a young Rick Perez. So Rick, before we wrap up, tell us how best people can reach out to your company, Avangard, and learn more about what you're up to.
Oh, thank you. Absolutely. Avangard Innovative. The best way to reach us, obviously, through our website is avaicg.com. And obviously, our social media, we're pretty much from LinkedIn, from Instagram, and Facebook. So yeah, I'd love to hear from you guys. We're always listening. We're always learning from everybody and any way we can help. We love it. So yeah, please reach out to us and see how we can help you guys.
Well, brother, you're a great American success story, a great Houston success story. I'm so proud of you. I'm so happy for you. And I think these are wonderful lessons for anyone and any business trying to build something. It's been a 30-year journey for you. So you become an overnight success in 30 years. So we'll get there.
Thank you much. No, and again, you know, it's a team effort and it's a lot of great advice, great advisory board, great friends like you and many others that have given me great advice through time. And, you know, it's listening and listening to the market and listening to people. And, it's hard work. And as if you do all those things, there's good things have to happen. Yeah. So thank you for having me.
For sure. Many years of success. Thanks, Rick.
Thank you so much, Mark.
This has been the Manufacture Houston podcast brought to you by Alchemy Industrial. For more information, check out alchemyindustrial.com. If you'd like to be on the show or want to recommend someone to get on the show, just reach out to me on LinkedIn. MUSHKHAN, Mushkan. I look forward to hearing from you.